Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. A string quartet contends with serious issues after 25 years together. A 38-year-old man confined to an iron lung wants to lose his virginity. These are just two of the plots in a list of independent foreign and documentary films that we'll be reviewing today with our very good critics. They are KCUR's Steve Walker. Stephen, how are you?
Morning, Steve.
And Bob Butler, the former Star film critic who curates film at the Kansas City Public Library and blogs at butlerscinemascene.com.
Bob, wow, I'm a curate now.
Yes, you are. I should point out Cynthia Haynes is away today, unfortunately. Well, let's get started with a film now out. It's called A Late Quartet. It's about a string quartet that's been together for more than two decades and now is struggling with some very serious issues. One of its stars is the great Christopher Walken, and Steve Walker had a chance to visit with him. Let's listen to that interview right now.
A Late Quartet is about a string quartet whose members have been working together for a long time, and it's centered around Beethoven's quartet in C-sharp minor, or Opus 131, which is said to be one of his most intricate and difficult pieces to play.
For the people who play this piece, it's a problem to stay in tune for that long. Keep playing. You know, I can't play any instrument, but we all have to take a lot of lessons in being able to simulate, you know, the fingering and bow strokes and that kind of thing.
Well, with your character being a cellist dealing with the onset of Parkinson's disease, did you research classical music, Parkinson's, both, or none? How did you approach this?
Well, my whole life I've listened to good music, and there's a lady in the movie who teaches the class of people who have are suffering from Parkinson's, and that lady, she was the one I consulted about Parkinson's. She's had the disease for 12 years, but she, you know, manages it beautifully. She had been a dancer, and maybe just that experience gives her a certain amount of control of her body. But then there's medication also, and we talked a lot about certain things that I should know, and I tried to incorporate that in the movie. Certain things, you know, how they walk up and down stairs, people with that affliction, and so on.
So in that scene where you're with her and several other people, was that a room filled with people also afflicted with Parkinson's?
Yes, that was a real thing, and that was a real class that she teaches.
You must have felt honored to be invited.
Oh, yes, and it was, you know, of course, you know, fascinating.
I surmise you get about a dozen scripts a day, so I want to ask, what drew you to Late Quartet as opposed to something like Seven Psychopaths, which is still playing here?
The movie appealed to me because it is so different from what I usually get asked to do. And Yaron Silberman, the director, writer, producer, came to my house maybe a year before we started shooting. And we talked about the script, and then the other actors came. It's a movie that didn't have a lot of money or a lot of time to shoot, and he attracted these really terrific actors. And it just seemed to me something that I couldn't let pass because it was so different for me.
Seven Psychopaths was written and directed by Martin McDonagh, who you also worked with. He wrote A Behanding in Spokane, which you did on Broadway. What draws you to his work, which is so dark and yet darkly funny?
Yes, well, exactly. And he didn't direct that play, but he was there all the time. And then, of course, with Sam Rockwell. So I knew both of them pretty well by the time we got to make Seven Psychopaths. He is he's a terrific writer.
So after A Late Quartet makes its rounds, what's next on your plate?
I don't know. In my career, I've never known really what's coming next. Even when things were going well, I don't know what I'm going to do next. But I never have. In this case, there are three movies opening in the space of maybe 5 or 6 weeks. I didn't make them at the same time, but they happen to converge. That happens sometimes.
What's the third one, Christopher?
It's called Stand Up Guys with Al Pacino and Alan Arkin, and that'll come in December, I think. So it seems like I'm busy, but I'm not.
One more question about Late Quartet. It must have been tempting to work with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Catherine Keener, who are always so good. What do you hope people take from this film?
You know, I'm happy with my performance in it. I sometimes I see myself in movies and I'm not that pleased, but I think I'm good in it, and I hope people see it. And of course, Phil Hoffman and Catherine Keener and Mark Ivanier, the Imogen Poots, the five basic actors are really terrific in it. It's one of those movies that has really good acting, and if you're an actor, you're always going to go see those. And I hope I hope a lot of actors see this movie.
Well, it really is a fine performance, and I appreciate you talking with us this morning.
Thank you.
That sounds great.
It was fun. That's
terrific. Yeah.
Yeah, it was in the middle of it. I was like, oh, my God.
That's Christopher
I'm really
Walken.
Talking to and you know Christopher what I, Walken from The Deer Hunter, who wanted, I mean, you know.
Yeah. You know what I like about him in this? He's supporting something I've long recognized. Actors like everybody else, only more insecure.
Yeah.
Where did you hear that? I'm curious.
Oh, from years of interviewing actors.
Oh, yeah.
So how's the film,
Steven? Oh, the film's really quite good, and he is so good in it because it's such a different kind of Walken performance. He's very quiet. He's a man struggling with his mortality and mm-hmm. the onset of this disease. And this quartet's been together 25 years, and he's announced to them that this will be his last one. And the last one they do is this complicated Opus 131 that is meant to be played uninterrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And so Keener's on viola, and she's married to Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, who's one of the violinists, and then this Mark Ivanier that he referred to is the other violinist. And there's some other things going on. Walken's, if he's nominated for this, which he may well be for supporting actor, it's mm-hmm. really Hoffman and Keener that are kind of the stars. And their marriage is kind of falling apart, and Hoffman's an egomaniac who is tired of being second violin. Mm-hmm. If you know any classical musicians, it's like, you know, the catch-up batter or whatever they call them in baseball.
Yeah.
But he's always been in that position. And then their daughter's kind of fooling around with the first violinist. So there's some soap opera-y things going mm-hmm. on. But when you have Walken and Keener and Hoffman together, they're three of the best actors going.
And I was going to say.
It's a beautifully shot movie. It's shot in New York. It looks like in the fall. And we have a clip if you want to hear it.
What's the clip? I would like to
hear it. It's Walken is the cellist, and he and Keener are visiting the Metropolitan Museum of Art and standing in front of a Rembrandt painting. And he's talking about his physical decline.
If you look at these pictures in a certain way, it's as if they open up. One might go inside and meet these people. They've been here watching, listening. Well, Miriam felt that one might exchange thoughts with them. She liked this one in particular.
What does Rembrandt say to you today?
I'm the boss. I'm the king of painters. I'm very great. And I know it. I'm getting old, but still, I'm at the height of my power. Look at the gaze from the shadow. He's strong. He's a bit silly in his gold dress and all. He knows that. But still, his body and mind have not betrayed him. Not yet.
It's inspiring.
My own body and mind is a different story.
Mm-hmm. Those two also have two of the most distinctive voices in film acting.
Yeah.
I love them both.
Oh, it sounds terrific.
Yeah, it is really good.
That film is titled A Late Quartet, right? Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to another film here that's drawing some attention, I guess, because of the subject matter and the stars of this film. It's titled The Sessions. Bob Butler tells about it.
This is a movie. You describe it, and you can see people's eyes starting to rolling at the potential for disaster, and yet it avoids it entirely. Hmm. It's based on the real story of Mark O'Brien, a man who lived in the Bay Area and suffered polio as a child. It left him paralyzed from the neck down. He spent 20 hours a day in an iron lung. And yet he could feel his entire body. And at the age of 38, he approached his parish priest and said, it's time for me to lose my virginity. And the priest, in an act of what, secular humanism, the unsurpassed
yeah, exactly.
in the priesthood, said, I think God's going to give you a pass on this. And it's about this man attempting to lose his virginity. He hires a sex surrogate, played by Helen Hunt,
mm-hmm.
of you know, Mad About You fame and an Oscar-winning actress, obviously.
Yeah.
She's a wife and mother, and her approach to this job is astonishing. This movie had so many possibilities for salaciousness, none of which.
None.
And I'm talking about an actress who takes off her clothes and keeps them off for the bulk of the movie. And you're thinking, well, wow, lurid, huh? Not the least, because her approach is so sympathetic. His fears are so great. His desire at the same time to achieve this something which for everyone else is just, you know, just a fact of life.
And her treatment of him is so compassionate.
Absolutely.
And so patient.
Now, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that it's probably short of an X-rated film. It's one of the more graphic films I've seen about the act.
And yet
of
it
sex.
Never feels in any way tawdry.
No, but because she's talking him through it. He's never been there. And it's really interesting.
Mark O'Brien is played by John Hawkes, who has become the chameleonic actor of our decade. He was in Winter's Bone. He was the meth head addicted Uncle Teardrop. You might remember he was a hillbilly meth head, and he was creepy and scary. Here, it's a 180-degree turnaround. He's just fantastically empathetic. He's a man with a self-deprecating sense of humor. He says witty things because he's a writer, although he has to type with a pencil in his mouth poking on an electric keyboard.
Mm-hmm. And his acting is all from the neck up.
Yes, he can't act with his body. And yet you never think of him as less than a fully human person.
No, you're right. That's a great
It's
point.
A fantastic
Sounds
performance.
Sounds terrific, yeah. We have a clip.
Yeah, this is Mark and his sex surrogate getting to know each other.
Okay.
So,
your money's on the desk over there.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
That was the wrong way to start off.
It really was. Shall we start again?
Please, you start.
Although the aim is for us to have sex, I'm not a prostitute. You don't have to pay me up front. I have nothing against prostitutes, but there's a difference. We can talk about that later.
I'm sorry.
The other thing is, there's a limit to the number of sessions we can have. Did Lara mention that when you saw her?
I'm sorry. I don't remember.
The limit is 6, but that gives us plenty of opportunity to explore.
6.
So, I understand you're able to have an erection.
Yes, but not by choice.
Now, you know, this movie was directed by Ben Lewin, who is himself a polio sufferer. He's in his late 50s and he gets around on crutches. So this movie was made by somebody that knew where this was coming from.
And there's also some really nice interactions with Hawks's character and his caretakers, and particularly this one woman who is Chinese-American, I believe. And they have a very funny, simpatico kind of dialogue through the whole thing where she's like, yeah, we know. You're rolling in for your thing. I get it. And that's really fun. And I have to say, short of a human sexuality class I took in college, I've never seen a film about sex and the disabled or sexuality and disability. And I think it's for that reason, it's a pretty important film, I'm sure, to a lot of people.
Well, Helen Hunt strikes me as such an inspired choice to play this role. Well,
she's really good.
Just listening to her voice,
yes.
You hear the person she is.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And you hear the empathy. And at the same time, there's a kind of matter-of-factness. Well, we're doing something that a lot of people would, you know, throw up their hands and go, oh, my God, oh, my God. She's just doing it about business, but never in a business-like way.
No.
Yeah, that's very well said. Yeah, absolutely.
Her job, she loves her job, and it comes from the heart, and her husband's fine with it.
Although
there are
a few moments
of
tension there.
Well, yeah, a couple, but we won't give everything away.
That film, again, is titled The Sessions. It's now open, right?
It's been open
here for a week. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about some of the best independent foreign and documentary films now showing with our critics today, Steve Walker and Bob Butler. We're 2 for 2 here so far,
Two
very strong films, The Sessions and A Late Quartet. Let's see if the string continues, Bob Butler, with a film titled The Paperboy.
Oops, we just hit the wall.
Uh-oh. Boom.
Okay. How shall I describe this? I'm going to call this a big old heaping plate of southern fried sleaze.
That's good.
It's sort of like a Jim Thompson novel, only even tackier.
Even though it stars Nicole Kidman,
it's got a terrific cast.
Sleaze, yeah.
It was directed by Lee Daniels, who gave us Precious a couple of years ago.
Right.
And you'd think,
it's his follow-up to that film.
Yeah. And it's a huge letdown for me. I didn't believe a minute of it.
Well, it's based on a Pete Dexter novel. and some people are big fans of him. I have never read him. And it opens with Macy Gray, the R&B singer, plays this family's maid. And she says, a lot of people have questioned what really happened. It was 1969. And I swear, from that 2 minutes, I was in.
And the story is what? Just summarize it in a sentence.
You've got Matthew McConaughey playing a sort of a black sheep son who comes back to his small town because a man has been accused of killing and murdering a policeman. He's in jail on death row, and a young woman, well, she's not that young anymore, played by Nicole Kidman, a good old Southern gal, kind of a floozy, has fallen in love with him without ever setting eyes on him and has been digging up evidence to have him freed. So you've got this newspaper reporter from the big city, you've got this girl, and you've got the reporter's younger brother who works for the family business, which is the local small town newspaper, throwing papers. And he was a kid that went to college, it all fell apart, and now he's desperately in love with this older woman played by Nicole Kidman.
He's got some mom issues.
Sounds pretty good.
Well, it's lurid trash, which if you're into that, like a pulp novel from you'd find at a garage sale, it's lurid, it's trashy. Kidman with her pink lipstick and her blue eyeshadow and her teased hair is fun to watch. Zac Efron, for fans of his, he has white tidy whities on for half the film and nothing else. And Lee Daniels apologized not a bit for that. McConaughey's always kind of fun.
McConaughey has had his best playing sleazy characters.
And who plays this killer that she's met
John
by writing?
Cusack,
John Cusack.
Who put on about 30 pounds, it looks like.
Right.
He's a real redneck oaf.
It's pretty vulgar. But I thought it was kind of like a guilty pleasure wallowing in, you know, what, 4,000 calorie plate of nachos and a bad margarita. It's trash. But
I just needed
it's
a shower.
Oh, so why does Nicole Kidman pick a role like this? Because she has such a dignified persona in the movies.
Good for her. The more people like her with her stature do independent films, only keeps independent films that more relevant. Because people would go see it who wouldn't normally.
I would agree with you there.
But she picked a film that's you're not crazy about.
Oh, I thought it was fun.
We have a split opinion here.
Okay.
Yeah.
I said it was lurid and trashy, and you know me better than that. That means I liked it.
He said it was lurid and trashy. He loved it. I say it's lurid and trashy, and I can do without it. So there you have it.
There's our split. Okay, I understand.
We do
now
have a clip. It's where Zac Efron tells Kidman how he got kicked out of college, and they're waiting outside a prison for her first glimpse of her supposed-to-be husband, who she's never seen.
Okay.
So?
Well, we was drunk one night, and I lost my temper. I emptied the pool.
At your college?
The University of Florida. They call that vandalism, I guess. It's actually not as easy to do as it sounds.
So you lose your temper often? This place is full of boys just like you who lost their temper one day.
God, that sounds like Tennessee Williams.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? It really does.
On a bad day.
Right. I mean, you know, one of my favorite party games is we do bad Tennessee Williams just on the spot. So that's what that sounds like.
Well, that's a split opinion on the film The Paperboy. Now out, a complete list of films we're talking about today on our website, kcur.org. Bob Butler, let's move to Smash. An alcoholic struggles to relate to his wife when she decides to sober up.
Yeah, this is I'm watching this movie and I'm thinking, boy, how many times have I already seen this? Going back to the days of Wine and Roses with Lee Remick and Jack Lemmon in the 60s. It's your basic alcoholic movie. It starts out with Mary Elizabeth Winstead, the wife in this pairing. She's in classroom. We've seen her out in the parking lot of school drinking. She comes in and immediately throws up in front of the kids, and and from that, the kids extrapolate that clearly teacher is pregnant. Soon she finds herself at a faculty baby shower for the baby that doesn't exist. Now, that sounds funny, but the film is not funny per se. She and her husband, played by Aaron Paul of TV's Breaking Bad, a tremendous actor, they are party animals. They go out drinking just about every night. And she, after waking up one morning on a old sofa underneath an overpass, reeking of cocaine and beer fumes, decides it might be time to clean up. And to the extent that it addresses a very real problem for recovering alcoholics, which is recovering spouses who don't want to recover,
right.
It creates a real situation.
So
that people,
one wants to recover, one
and
doesn't.
The, and the yeah. other one, even if he wants to, he probably can't. He's not motivated in the same way she is, and that drives a wedge in a relationship.
The one scene that I didn't care for, and I'll tell you why in a second, but there is one scene. Mary Kay plays her mother, and it's the classic enabler. They go over, and she greets them. It's in the morning, I would assume. Oh, you're here. I didn't know you were coming. Let me, whip up a pitcher of Bloody Marys. She said, Mom, I'm not drinking anymore. We're not drinking. Oh, you don't know what you're saying. You're not drinking what? Today or...
Yeah, you're not drinking hard
just
stuff.
Just doesn't hear her because where Mom's at, she just doesn't hear her mm-hmm. daughter. What I didn't buy at all was the complete performance of this Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who plays the alcoholic. I thought she was really terrible. And... from the minute it started, I mean, if I can't buy in a character in a movie with this much realism, I'm like, oh, you are so all over the room. You're acting. Tone it down. It was like a drama class exercise. And because she was so bad and she's in almost every scene, I just, wasn't a fan.
My problem is less with her per se than with the setup, which if you're going to do an oft-told tale, find some new way to tell it, and there just wasn't that special something. Oh, by the way, I have to mention that my favorite character in this is a fellow teacher and alcoholic played by Nick Offerman, whom you may recognize as the right-wing guy on Parks and Recreation, the TV show. Mm-hmm. Talk about a chameleon. I almost didn't. I said, where have I seen this guy before?
He's married to Megan Mullally from Will and Grace, who plays the principal.
Right.
And Aaron Paul's great. And I love Breaking Bad, but this movie, no.
Well, this film was received pretty well at Sundance, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I hear.
I guess every generation gets its alcoholic movie. And
what's the clip we have for this film?
Well, this is alcoholic Aaron Paul. He's struggling to relate to his newly sober wife.
I just keep thinking how I wish I was meeting you for the first time in a bar. And I didn't have any of this baggage, and I could buy you a drink and flirt with you all night.
Actors have said playing drunk is one of the hardest things to do.
Really?
And they said what too many actors do is you play the drunk. You play to the drunkenness, to the slurred speech or all that, whatever. Yeah. When in fact you need to play as if you're trying to remain as if you are sober to everyone in the room. It's like a fine line, and I think she blew it big time. Mm. She was all over the room.
Okay, and Bob,
I'm not as opposed to it as Steve is, but I was not
floored,
blown away by it.
Okay,
no.
Not high praise for the movie Smashed. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our review of the latest independent foreign and documentary film showing. Now we'll go to The Imposter, a film titled Bill W, and we'll talk about some coming attractions, including Silver Linings Playbook. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're back. I'm Steve Kraske. We're talking about the latest independent foreign and documentary film showing with our critics, KCUR Steve Walker and Bob Butler, the former Star film critic who blogs at butlercinemascene.com. Cynthia Haynes could not be with us today. If you've seen some of these films, or if you can tell us what you're looking forward to seeing in the big Christmas season lineup of films coming out, give us a phone call, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Okay, let's go to a film. It's The Imposter. It's a documentary about a film who convinces a family that he is, in fact, their long-lost son, Steve Walker.
Yeah, in 1994, 13-year-old Nicholas Barkley, a San Antonio teenager, goes missing. And the family is understandably devastated. 3 years later, they get a call from Spain. And they said, we think we have found him. And then the FBI gets involved. And halfway through the film, we're watching this all unfold. We see the actual footage of when this guy from Spain, who isn't their son, but has claimed to be, he's a 22-year-old psychopath, practically. The family so wants to believe that their son is okay, that this is their son, that sitting across from them in his living room, they believe it for a while.
They want to believe it.
This movie is so good and so outlandish that you'd never believe it if someone
and
wrote it.
This is a documentary.
This is a documentary, yeah.
True story.
Yeah.
Bart Layton, who directed and wrote this, did a masterful job of presenting the pieces in a like a huge mystery that's slowly unraveling. You start out looking at this guy who's now in his 40s, a guy named Frederick Bourdin, and he's talking about how he was terrified that people would find out that he was faking it, how in the youth hostel where he was being kept by the Spanish authorities, he went to the office and started getting on the internet and calling around trying to find a child he could impersonate, came up with the name of this kid from Texas. This is a guy who was not only 6 years older than this kid would have been.
Mm-hmm.
He was starting to grow a beard. He had brown eyes. The kid had blue eyes. He had dark hair. The kid had blonde hair. But this guy found ways to snow everybody. He even went and had one of the other kids in the group home put on the jailhouse-type tattoo that this missing 13-year-old kid had done way back several years before.
Plus, he speaks with a Spanish accent.
Yeah.
I mean, he's
from
Spain.
How could they buy into this? Well, he fooled the FBI. Yep. He fooled everybody.
But you know what I mean about this family wanting so badly
to
believe it.
Absolutely.
That it's
and
true.
He found that by saying little and always keeping his head buried in a hoodie, he was able to coast an awful long way. Now, what makes it really interesting is toward the end of the film, you're almost rooting for this guy because he's shown so much perseverance, so much creativity, you know. And then, late in the film, the depths of his depravity really comes out, and it just knocks you for a loop.
It does, and so does the family's tiny, slow realization that this is not Nicholas.
Well, how did the documentary filmmaker sort of get onto this story? And I'm assuming the filmmaker didn't know at the beginning what he or she was in for.
Well, it happened in 94, so this is...
It was on like 60 Minutes, and there were segments on the news back in the day. In fact, there was a fictional film 3 years ago with Ellen Barkin about this situation. And like my thought was, if someone had made a fictional film about this, you'd never believe it.
Right.
Well, they did.
It's filmed with a mix of like Errol Morris's, with the way he artfully stages
scenes. A lot of recreations.
There's an actor used who never really speaks, but he plays the – what's his name, Bob?
His name is Frederick Bourdin.
He plays Frederick Bourdin back in 97 when he is found huddled and crying and hungry in a phone booth by some tourists. And that all starts to unfold. And then as the family realizes, you know, I'm not going to give us more away than we have, but that this isn't him, then the movie shifts and goes, then what happened to Nicholas?
Mm-hmm.
And that starts to unravel.
You know, this movie, in the way it's set up, it reminded me a little bit of that documentary Capturing the Freedmans about an infamous child molestation case, which may or may not have ever happened.
Right, right.
In the sense that it gives you reality, and then it just shows you that however weird fiction can be, reality is weirder still.
It's playing only at the Tivoli, I believe. It is one of the better documentaries
you will see. It is terrific.
Wow. That film is The Imposter. Okay. Steve Walker, tell us about Bill W., a documentary about the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Well, Bill W. is Bill Wilson. Mm-hmm. And this is a documentary told with a lot of old footage and a lot of use of old video recordings of speeches he would make at various conferences and meetings. He is the man who one night reached out to a friend. He was struggling with his drinking. His wife was over it, and he said he needed some support. He needed to talk to someone who'd been there, and that got him through that night. And as we all know, eventually that sort of became the whole tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you don't use your last name, that you always reach out, that you have a sponsor, right. And so it kind of just documents this man's life, his early success in business and his decline in business due to his drinking. And there are several people who you know, say that AA saved their lives. True to the anonymity, they're shot in shadow. But there are also a lot of people who are scholarly followers of Bill W. and Alcoholics Anonymous. There's apparently sort of a museum and a tribute to him in his old home, and the woman who runs that is shown full face. I mean, mm-hmm. And then with all the mix of all the clips, you know, you really get to know who this man is and how this organization has helped a great deal of people, millions and millions of people. You know, it's not the most original. The Imposter, an original
documentary. Novel.
Mm-hmm. This is very traditional. Mm-hmm. Clips, old sound, talking heads. So in that regard, you know, it didn't offer anything, you know, innovative.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting story, I mean, nonetheless.
Okay, that film, Bill W., if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're running through the latest independent foreign and documentary films, now showing with KCUR Steve Walker and Bob Butler from the Kansas City Public Library. There are some things coming up, Bob, that you want people to be aware of. Some events at the library,
yeah.
No doubt. Some very good events.
Some good events. I'll start with Daniel Craig. He is, of course, the new James Bond.
Man.
Currently at the downtown library on Monday nights and Saturday
He's working
afternoons.
There?
I wish.
He's the guy behind
I wish.
Checking out the book.
But we are showing the movies he made before he became Bond.
Well, I've known
He's
about him for years.
Astoundingly
yeah.
versatile actor.
Yeah.
He did everything from playing one of the killers in the Clutter murder case in Kansas.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
The gangster son of Paul Newman in Road to Perdition, which he played one of the sleaziest, most repellent characters mm-hmm. you've ever seen. This is a man with a lot of arrows in his quiver. He isn't just James Bond. So that's great. Now, this Sunday at 1:30 at the Plaza Branch, one of the greatest movies ever. It's part of the Movies That Matter series, The Bicycle Thieves, Italy, 1948. This is a movie that when you're a film student and you have to watch all these masterpieces of world mm-hmm. cinema, this is the one when it's over. First, you don't want anybody to see you're crying. Second, you say to yourself, so that's what movies can do. For almost 10 years after it came out, it was repeatedly elected or voted as the greatest movie of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was 70 years ago, almost 70 years ago. But nonetheless, it's a movie that packs incredible power about a father and a son searching through Rome in post-war Rome, trying to find the stolen bicycle they need for him to earn a living. It's great stuff.
Back to the Daniel Craig thing you're doing. Are you guys showing Love is the Devil?
No.
It's a biographical film about the great English painter Francis Bacon.
No, and that one we couldn't get the rights to. You know, we just can't show anything we want to. We have to find for certain. We are
Layer cake?
Absolutely. Okay. We're even doing Sylvia, where he played the poet Ted
Hughes
against Gwyneth Paltrow's Sylvia Plath. So this is a man with lots going on.
Oh, yeah. No, I've known who he is way before he was cast as Bond, because he was so striking looking, and then he's so good and intense. I knew who Daniel Craig was, and then when I heard he was going to be Bond, I was like, really? We'll see.
Yeah, you saw.
And A Bicycle Thief is at 1:30 Sunday at the Plaza Branch.
Right, absolutely.
And this film holds up today.
Oh, are you kidding? I mean, bring your hankies, guys.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds just terrific. Okay. How about some other coming attractions, things coming up? You've both seen Silver Linings Playbook, Steve Walker. A young man returns home after spending time in an institution.
We're coming upon, once again, the season where all of the big serious films.
Also known as the Film Critic Marathon.
And the adult films. Not adult films like The Paperboy.
Mature films.
Yeah,
intelligent
films. Films for people who read a paper and are smart. And who have conversations.
Thank you.
Instead of looking at their phone.
Being smart and reading a newspaper.
Anyway.
He wasn't looking at me when he said
Silver
that.
Linings Playbook is the follow-up from David O. Russell, who, was it 2 years now since The Fighter?
I think so.
Was his, just blew me away, The Fighter. Oh, my God, it was so great. And I didn't know David O. Russell had it in him. But here he's got this guy who's coming out of the hospital. He's been there 8 months. Bradley Cooper.
Seriously, mentally
bipolar.
Challenged. Yeah,
he's bipolar. His dad is Robert De Niro, who's also very OCD about the
Philadelphia Eagles.
Oh, is that it? Okay. And he meets Jennifer Lawrence, who is one of our favorites at this table from Winter's Bone, who is also kind of unbalanced.
Yeah, it's a love story. Do you remember the old '60s movie David and Lisa?
Vaguely,
it was about two people in a mental institution who fall in love. Well, this is where we've come. That was a very somber story. This one is almost a screwball comedy on some level.
Almost, yeah.
And not to say it doesn't have some very serious things, because Bradley Cooper is hitting depths here. His character is so desperate and so tormented and trying so hard to be normal, and you can see where he's unraveling all the time. Little things set him off.
Yeah, it opens next Wednesday, and we'll review it fully on our next show when all three of us will be back together. But I just want to say, I think Jennifer Lawrence was incredible in this.
I will too, and I'll tell you why. Because I think the character is almost unbelievable, and she sells it.
She does. She's talk about depth behind those eyes.
Well, what other films, what other actors are going to – we can be seeing their names when it comes to Oscar season?
I think Jennifer Lawrence. I think De Niro for supporting. I think
who's in this film, Silver Linings Playbook.
Lincoln opens today.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
I haven't seen Lincoln.
Well, you know what?
And it's not an indie, so we can't really talk about it. But
let's just say that, 2 minutes in, you're not seeing Daniel Day-Lewis. You're seeing freaking Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
That's what everybody says about it. Yeah.
And I thought, two shows ago, I said, Joaquin Phoenix will hands down be the one to beat for The Master. And now I hear Daniel Day-Lewis is pretty phenomenal.
Hey, let's not forget John Hawks.
Oh, yeah. He'll be nominated for sure for The Sessions.
How about best film? What are we looking at?
I think early
predictions?
Argo, Lincoln.
I think Argo. That's going to be a popular favorite.
Argo's really hanging in
there.
It's
a good movie that's also fun. Yeah. And it isn't snobbish. Anyone can enjoy it.
Silver Linings Playbook will be. We don't know how many films are going to nominate every year. Lincoln. Don't know what else.
I'm going to take you to task there. I think Lincoln has a great performance in a kind of boring movie.
Well, I haven't seen it, Bob.
You gave it a B grade, I think.
I did, because you can't ignore this performance, but it's sort of like a history lesson.
Yeah, no, I heard it's very talky. And Sean Edwards, who was at a screening earlier this week, said that he was very offended by Lincoln's inability or Spielberg's inability to really show what slavery was about. It's a bunch of white people talking about slavery.
And that's absolutely true.
And I said, is that really what it is? And he said, absolutely. I said, well, that's offensive.
Well, I don't know if it's offensive, because the story is about how a bunch of white guys outlawed slavery.
Yeah.
But
it's a shortcoming.
It's a shortcoming for sure, much like The Impossible, which is coming out with Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor about the tsunami in 2004. And their three children are caught up in the tsunami that killed 230,000 people. Mm. Again, cultural competence and diversity I teach at KU. So that's my other life, and that's maybe why I sound like I'm on a soapbox. But you couldn't think they could find one story about someone native to that land? No, it's about rich white tourists.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember back when apartheid was big, and you invariably went to see movies about how rough apartheid was for white people in South Africa?
Right. I mean, it's an unbelievably shortcoming. Very well put, Steve.
They know the audience, and the audience is not minority people from around the world. It's white Americans.
The tsunami scene, however, if you're afraid of water,
don't go see it.
If you're afraid of walking into a ocean, you will be horrified. It's very well done.
So it sounds like you're portraying an Oscar season that's going to be pretty darn
up and down, and could be really interesting.
Extremely diverse,
Yeah, okay. Let's move on to a film, A Royal Affair, one other film that's coming out in a week or so at the Tivoli. This is an historical drama based on fact. In fact, set in 18th century, and it involves a love triangle.
Yeah, it's a Danish movie.
Yeah.
And I believe it's Denmark's official Oscar nomination for the foreign language film. It's based on a real incident of a man, a court doctor played by Mads Mikkelsen, who was the baddie in the Casino Royale, the first Bond movie with Daniel Craig. And he becomes a friend of the King of Denmark, King Christian, who is like a 24-year-old frat boy, basically. All he cares about is visiting the bordellos and getting drunk.
And he was like Mozart a little bit, not Amadeus. He's just a big brat.
And and the king is married to an English princess whom he provides her with a child and then pretty well blows her off, and she falls into the arms of the doctor. Well, but the queen and the doctor are able to manipulate the king into all sorts of social reforms. Except you can imagine what the landed gentry and the military think of these reforms, which they see cutting into their power. It all ends rather badly.
They all pretty much are very literally saying it's the Age of Enlightenment. Like, people would have those conversations. I don't know if they did or not, but
Anyway,
he's very forward thinking.
If you like your costume dramas, I think you'll probably enjoy this one.
Yeah,
and I believe that opens next week, doesn't it?
I think it does.
November 21st at the Tivoli.
There we go.
Next week, yeah. That's a royal affair. How about Life of Pi? A shipwreck leaves an Indian boy adrift at sea with a Bengal tiger, a zebra, a hyena, and an orangutan.
Yeah. Well, I don't think either of us have seen this
yet. I haven't seen it.
We're going to see it on Monday.
I've heard from other critics, though, that it's the 3D. If you have to see it in 3D because it's – they kept saying it's the best 3D I've seen in years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's Ang Lee, directed by Ang Lee.
Who doesn't often mess up. Yeah.
No, not often.
And, you know, the
preview for it's spectacular.
It is. Yeah, the interesting thing about it, have you guys read the book?
No, I haven't.
Well, the book is one of those double whammy things where you're watching this whole story told in the first person by the shipwrecked boy. And at the end of the movie, they throw in a heavy hint that he is a totally unreliable narrator.
Hmm.
Now, how you handle that in the real world of cinema is going to be very tricky, but people I've talked to say they pull it off.
What do you think about Cloud Atlas, which cost $200 million and opened to $9 million on its opening weekend?
Hmm.
With the Tom Hanks, Halle Berry thing?
Yeah.
Gosh,
yeah.
I've heard no one talk about that movie.
I haven't either.
And you could have made 50 sessions.
Oh, I know. I know.
Going
it's
down
just
the
like,
drain.
There you go.
Ang Lee, we're talking about Life of Pi. His track record, as you said, is pretty impeccable.
I even the movies, a lot of people, things like, what was the Woodstock movie he did? Becoming Woodstock?
Something like that.
Yeah. Which didn't approach the Woodstock Festival.
I liked it.
I loved it.
Yeah.
It was about a kid on the periphery of it and how it affected him. You know, he made one of the great Civil War movies right here in Kansas
Race
City about
Devil
15
film.
Years ago, Ride with the Devil.
A
film that is now, in retrospect, regarded as something of a cult classic.
And
the time, it was thrown away by the studio.
I didn't like it at the time. Well, you and I had a conversation many years ago, I've seen
film.
It since and have I like it.
It's basically Huckleberry Finn and Jim go to war. It's the story of a black man and a white kid, learning about each other.
And we, Brokeback Mountain and the Ice Storm are two, wonderful films, too.
How about Anna Karenina? That's gotten a little bit of buzz, too. The adaptation of the epic love story set in 19th century high society written by Leo Tolstoy.
I read the review this morning in the New York Times, and it looks, if you've seen the trailer, it looks just so bizarre. And what are they doing? And it turns out that they're filming it. Joseph Wright has made this film as if they're in a theater, as if you're watching a play.
Yeah.
The Moscow's like a stage set. A train comes in that's obviously what you might see in a big Broadway musical. I can't wait to see it.
It
looks spectacular.
He did Pride and Prejudice with the same leading lady, Keira Knightley, about 5 years ago.
And Atonement.
And I thought it was one of – it's one of my favorite adaptations Jane Austen, because – didn't feel the need to put every bit of Jane Austen in the movie. It was a movie as opposed to a literary adaptation.
Right. Yeah. So here we are. We're talking excitedly about all these big, smart, intelligent films that are all coming out in a matter of 5 weeks.
Yes, and although it isn't an art film, it might qualify in the long run. It looks like Les Mis might be pretty interesting.
How about Hitchcock, a fictionalized drama about the making of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho?
I didn't see it, Bob.
Well, my fear is that it will appeal only to, movie geeks who know this sort of thing. But in fact, I think your average young person could learn a lot about media, about film history by watching this, because Psycho was essentially a turning point in American film. It was a turning point in commercial sense. It was in thematic sense, in the way movies were made and financed in all these ways. You've got Anthony Hopkins playing Hitchcock. Now, I'm not going to tell you he looks that much like Hitchcock, but he sounds and moves like Hitchcock.
Mm. And if you have HBO, you must know that there's a similar film showing on HBO called The Girl about the making of The Birds, with Toby Jones playing Hitchcock, Sienna Miller playing Tippi Hedren, which is really interesting and really dark.
Well, it's very dark because, of course, remember the famous Spoto biography of Hitchcock was called The Dark Side of Genius.
Oh,
and the idea being that here was this very physically unpleasant-looking man who was surrounded by beautiful people. He's working in Hollywood, and what that kind of did to his psyche.
Well, and when they didn't reciprocate on his advances, he ends up shooting that last scene from The Birds. He tells her it's going to be one day, no real birds.
And
it ends up being real birds, 5 days.
Yes.
He threw birds at her and put her through that.
Man.
Yeah, that's a devastating scene in the HBO film.
We just have a minute left in this segment. How about Hyde Park on the Hudson, a month in June of 1939, in the life of President Franklin D. Roosevelt?
Talk about what you think is crazy casting.
Yeah.
FDR is played by Bill Murray.
Yeah, of all people.
And there's no shtick there at all.
No.
He's doing it, playing it absolutely seriously.
Yeah.
You've got... Why can't I think of who's... Laura Linney is playing one of his distant cousins. Whom he asked to come to Hyde Park one summer and basically babysit him. I mean, this is a man, of course, who could not move around on his own, who had crutches and who moved very painfully just to get up and go from one chair to another. And it's a love story. And it will probably open your eyes to the fact that the peccadilloes of American presidents go way back.
It opens when? Do we know?
I think early December.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know when Kansas City gets it.
I've been for weeks and months, actually. Hey, we're out of time. I'm going to thank KCUR Steve Walker and Bob Butler, who blogs at butlercinemascene.com. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, we'll see you next month.